Despite what cult classic Mega Shark vs. Giant Octopus would let you believe, the Megalodon was the most massive shark that ever lived. Scientists recently discovered that its gargantuan girth was highly unusual, even among sharks. Joining us to discuss this and other stories is Dr. Ben Lewis, our science correspondent. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Zoe. Good morning, Tom.
So, exactly how big was this Megalodon?
Yeah, Megalodon, you were right in your introduction. It was the biggest shark that ever lived. And when I say ever, it lived between about 23 and 3 million years ago. So, there's no worries. There's no concerns about going into the beach anymore if you've got regular shark-sized sharks to worry about. But Megalodon, some researchers have looked at the fossilized teeth that we have of the Megalodon and sort of use those to track back and work out just how big was it. And it turns out they're around about 15 meters long. Now, to give you an idea, the great white shark at the moment, which is the biggest shark that's alive today, is around about maybe 6 or 7 meters long. And whale sharks, well, they're about 8 to 9 meters long. So we're sort of talking, the Megalodon is about twice as long as the biggest sharks that are alive today. So really big, really mean, really huge and terrifying.
And so we knew that these sharks did exist. How did it take so long to get an idea of how large they initially were?
Yeah, so the sharks, and in particular like Megalodon, is quite interesting because it's, with most, you know, prehistoric animals and dinosaurs and things like that, we find their fossilized bones. Sharks, for example, they don't really have bones. Their bones are made of cartilage, which means they don't really fossilize. They tend to break down too easily or they get eaten by other animals. So really the only kind of the major hints that we've got about Megalodon are from the size of their teeth. And what the researchers have just done is sort of looked at the teeth of different species of sharks and then tried to build like a mathematical model that says, all right, a tooth of this size would mean the shark was this big. And they sort of built that using a whole bunch of sharks that are alive today and then sort of went back and started applying it to things like Megalodon and applying it to other prehistoric sharks as well. And found, yeah, this model actually fit really well. So we've always figured that the Megalodon is probably around about 10 to 20 metres in size, but this is the sort of some of the best evidence we've got that sort of narrowed that down. Now, there's always sort of also been the question, all right, if Megalodon was so big, was that just because all sharks back then were really big? Was Megalodon just an average shark size, but we just happen to know about it now? Well, looking at other fossils that we've always had and other teeth and things like that, they looked at other species that would have been alive at around about the same time that Megalodon was alive, and Megalodon was huge. It was huge even back then. It wasn't like all sharks were massive back then, and Megalodon was one of them. It was, you know, the biggest sharks alive back then, 23 million years ago, were still around about that 6 to 7 meters long. So Megalodon was about twice as big as sharks alive today. It was also about twice as big as sharks alive back then. It's huge and it's always been huge.
And moving on, scientists have found a promising super habitable planet that may be better than Earth that we know it. If any of our audience is interested, how far do they have to get to be able to reach this planet?
Yeah, so whenever we talk about habitable planets, I always sort of say, you know what, they're hundreds of light years away or they're thousands of light years away. Unfortunately, this is no different. We're still talking about 100 light years away. So there's no chance we can ever sort of like go and visit one of these planets. But it does seem kind of strange that we're talking about a super habitable planet and a planet that might even be more conducive for life than Earth itself. And that sounds strange because you sort of think, well, the only place that we know that there is life is on Earth. Therefore, Earth must be the best place for life. But some researchers from the United States sort of started thinking about it and went, all right, if we sort of tweak some of these conditions, would it actually make it easier for life to come about? What if we increased the amount of water that was on these planets? That would surely be a good thing for life. If we actually increased the size of the planet, about 10% bigger would mean there's more land for life to live on. But if you went up to about 1.5 times the size of Earth, it's got a little bit more gravity, and it will actually stay warmer. The planet will stay warmer for longer, and it'll hold on to its atmosphere for longer. And that's got to be better for, you know, producing life as well, because it gives you more time for life to come about. So they started sort of tweaking some of these sort of factors, and they found that there are about 24 planets that we know of. We know of about 4,500 other planets that aren't Earth. There's about 24 of those which the researchers sort of consider to be super habitable. They actually have better conditions for life than what we find on Earth. But as I sort of said, they're 100 light years away. Chances of ever visiting to find out are pretty much zero, unfortunately.
So Ben, just theoretically speaking, is there a quantifiable measure for the best inhabitable planet for at least people?
I would say quantifiable, not really. You're sort of looking at a balance of factors. So the first thing is that the planets sort of need to be the right distance away from their star, in what's called the Goldilocks zone. It's not too hot and it's not too cold. Earth is obviously in one of those, but then so is Mars and Venus. And as far as we're aware, there's no life on Mars and Venus. There's maybe some signs of something that might, maybe, but as far as we know, there's no life on Mars or Venus. So, and Mars and Venus are very, very different to Earth. So this is part of the reason these researchers did this research is, can we start thinking a little bit more strategically about what would be the factors for life and characteristics of a planet that is actually perfect for life? So they're sort of looking at the balance. Like I said, there are about 24 which they sort of said, well, these are a good balance of this sort of, you know, super habitableness. But there's, I think, 4 in particular, they started ticking a lot of the boxes. So it's not like we can sort of say, well, that there's a 99% chance there is life on that planet. There's too many factors, too many variables involved. But we know that these are very, very good places, and it's got all the sort of things lined up for life to have come about.
Science communicator Dr. Ben Lewis is talking about the latest research in the science world. And finally, we all know snakes can be a bit mean sometimes, but one particular snake has really outdone themselves lately. What has been found out about snakes' vicious behaviour?
Yeah, I'm sorry for bringing this up during breakfast.
Yes, that's a good point. Warning to anyone who's eating right now.
Yeah. So we're in Thailand, in particular a snake called the Kukri snake. And you know, normally snakes bite and sort of envenomate, inject their venom into an animal, and that kills it. And then they either rip chunks off the animal, or quite often they just swallow their prey whole. Well, the Kukri snake has been found to have a very, very different way of killing its prey and eating its prey. It specifically targets a particular type of toad. And when it comes up to its toad, it's got razor-sharp teeth, the snake. It comes up to the toad, and it kind of tries to slash the side of the toad with its teeth, as you sort of would slash with a knife. And if it can slash enough times and actually cut the side of the toad open, it then plunges its head into the cut, into the splash that it's made, and starts eating the individual organs of the toad while the toad is still alive.
So it's basically... Oh, why are you laughing? That's not okay.
I'm with Tom on this. Yeah. It's sort of so disgusting, the only thing you can do is laugh. But yeah, it basically cuts open the side of the toad with its teeth and then sticks its head in and just starts nibbling away at its organs inside. It'll take a little bit of its liver or its kidney or some of its gastrointestinal, you know, its intestines or its stomach, and it essentially start eating the inside of the toad. The toad is still alive while all this is happening, I should point out, and it kind of knows what's happening. There's just nothing it can do about it. Eventually, the toad dies, and the snake eats all its internal organs, and it basically leaves the outer husk of the toad. It just leaves the skin of the toad behind, and the snake goes off to find another meal.
And so is there a reasonable reason that these snakes have been acting this way?
Well, we're not 100% sure, but there's a really good sort of idea that these toads actually have a defensive venom in itself. They're poisonous, but they release this poison from their sort of neck and their back. So if you're a snake and you come along and you sort of try to attack the toad as you normally would, which is biting it on its back, you're going to get this poison on you. Same sort of thing. If you try to swallow the toad whole, you're going to be swallowing that poison. So maybe the snakes have basically worked this out and realized that if you go in from the belly side of the toad, you can avoid where that poison is and sort of get to the deliciousness inside, but avoiding all the defensive sort of measures. So that's the best sort of explanation we've got for it at the moment. And you know what? That's probably pretty accurate. It seems like a good way of doing it and a good explanation for why this snake sort of slashes and gashes its way in.
Well, Ben, you never fail to bring us the grossest stories possible. Thank you so much for your time.
It's been fun. Thank you, guys.
Science communicator Dr. Ben Lewis speaking with us there about a really nasty snake and some other news from the science world.